and a wonderful person at the University of Maryland's Observatory, where we met before the COVID, and I presume we'll meet afterwards. We've all been vaccinated. Okay. So welcome to the October meeting of the National Capital Astronomers. Let me see. The vice president is here, so we will eventually will introduce the speaker. Is David Dunham here?
Yes, he is.
David, do you want to say anything about any occultation stuff that we have upcoming?
Yes, I'm here, but there's really haven't been doing too much. There's one event coming up with a very faint star being occulted by the Lucy target Orus. It's a Trojan asteroid. It'll be a very difficult event. I have a little note about it in the Stardust so people can see it there. Otherwise, also in Stardust, there was a TNO occultation that was actually observed across the eastern U.S. In August.
Remind us of what TNO stands for.
Oh, Trans-Neptunian Object.
Oh, okay.
One of those large Kuiper Belt objects. Ixion is its name. It was discovered in 2001, I think, and they didn't know how large it was at the time, but they knew it was pretty big from its brightness. And it was over 700 kilometers across. Wow. So we got people in New York, Georgia, and Illinois all observed it. And you can see the three chords that really show its size and a bit of its elliptical shape in the Stardust.
Well, I see Nancy Bird is with us. So I haven't seen her in a while.
Hi.
I mean, she's actually pretty far away. So that's one
and
of the things.
This is one of the happier manifestations of the COVID-19. I get to come to your meeting.
Right. People that normally wouldn't be able to join us are able to join us. Maybe after we start meeting in reality, we can at least extend some of this wonderfulness so that people far away that are still members but used to come regularly when they lived in the Washington metro area can come again and hear us again. Jack, tell us about the upcoming meeting in October for the Mid-Atlantic Senior Physics Group. Jack Gaffey?
Yes. On Wednesday, October 21 at 1:00, Carrie Anderson from the Planetary Systems Branch at NASA Goddard will talk about the Cassini-Huygens mission to the Saturn system. There is a link to the Zoom meeting in the calendar of events on page 7 in Stardust.
Have I left anybody out that needs to address all of us?
There's obviously no exploring the sky.
Right. So that would be Jay Miller, who is here too. Is that the moon that you have as your background, Jay?
Yeah, I'm the resident lunatic.
Okay.
Yeah, that's Apollo 17.
Okay, cool. Anybody else before I turn over the introductions to our vice president? Okay, I'm going to mute myself, so go on, introduce our great speaker.
Well, it's a very great pleasure to introduce Dr. Michael Walter, our speaker this evening. He performs experiments on rocks and minerals and pure substances subjected to the intense pressures and high temperatures that can occur deep in the Earth and, of course, deep inside other planets. And he measures the abundances of isotopes. So he's able to obtain evidence on the origin and evolution of the interiors of the Earth and of other planets. For example, he and his colleagues measured the melting curve of mixtures of nickel and silicon at pressures up to 700,000 atmospheres. That's basically 3/4 of a million atmospheres. He finds answers to questions like these. What happens to carbonate in oceanic crust that is subducted into the Earth's lower mantle? How soluble is sulfur in deep magma? What do diamonds and the minerals trapped within them tell us about carbon cycles deep in the Earth's mantle and about how the Earth's crust is recycled? He's especially interested in how planets form from the material swirling around a newly formed star, how collisions between protoplanetary material and between planets change the compositions of those bodies, how planets melt, how early planets cool, crystallize, and evolve, how volatile elements like water and carbon are stored and transported in Earth's interior, and the origin of super deep diamonds and their mineral inclusions, and what that reveals about Earth's deep mantle. Of course, his research also involves developing computerized models of geochemical processes in extremely diverse and extreme conditions. Dr. Walter does research and is also the deputy director at the newly formed Earth and Planets Laboratory of the Carnegie Institution of Science, which is the merger of two former Carnegie departments that were well known to us, the Geophysical Laboratory and the Department of Terrestrial Magnetism. Previously, Dr. Walter was a professor at the University of Bristol in the UK for 15 years. Before that, he was a professor at the Institute for the Study of the Earth's Interior in Japan. Last year, in recognition of his contributions to the field, Dr. Walter was elected a fellow of the American Geophysical Union, which is a very high honor. Dr. Walter.
Thank you so much for that introduction. And I'm really, really pleased to be here. And you touched on virtually everything I'm going to talk about. All those areas in some way I've tried to knit into this talk. It's a very wide, broad subject, this business of water in our solar system and in our planet in particular. So let's charge ahead. And while I've kind of organized this talk in two parts, and I often think of our Earth's surface as a plane, and we can take our telescopes and we can look in one direction and we can see the vastness of the cosmos, and you all know a lot about that. But if you turn your telescopes the other direction and you try to peer in the other side of the plane we live on, it's a fairly opaque bunch of rock and you don't get to see a lot. And there's a lot happening on that other side of the plane, and we have to figure out new kinds of telescopes, if you will, to peer there. And I'll talk to you about both of those things today. Can you see my arrow, by the way, on the screen? When I move it around? No?
No, I don't see it. Usually the mouse works, but I'm surprised I don't see it.
Okay, I'll just keep that in mind. I'll try not to refer to things that I'm pointing at. So you see here on this slide, we're going to start kind of with the big picture, because to understand water, you kind of first need to understand what's happening in protoplanetary disks. And on the left-hand side, we see a picture, a beautiful image from ALMA, where we can actually now begin to image planet formation in other systems. And one way to interpret the dark areas in those images is that the planets are forming and they're sculpting out, or they're carving out their feeding zones. And the reason I bring this in is because this is one way in which planets can obtain their water, is simply from the material that goes into as they accrete, depending on where they're at in the nebula. And of course, these nebulas are made primarily of hydrogen and helium, something like 98% or so in the case of our solar system, with most of that being hydrogen. So you might start from the premise that, well, water should be everywhere, at least the potential to have water in a planet is everywhere. But when we look at least our terrestrial planets in our solar system, of course, the inner planets besides Earth, well, Earth has an ocean of water at the surface, but they're pretty dry. And why is that? And that's what we're going to be discussing in the first part of this talk. And if you look at the diagram on the right, what I'm showing here is a plot showing the log abundance of elements in the solar photosphere. And on the x-axis, we have the log abundance in CI chondritic meteorites. And the reason I'm showing this is because I'm going to talk a little bit about meteorites. And the CI chondrites, many of you will probably know this already, but some of you might not. These are a type of chondrite that represents what we think is the most primitive material in the solar system. This is probably the stuff that was floating around, undifferentiated, and which at least some of the planets could have been made of. And we know that because there's this pretty much one-to-one abundance for at least all of the metals, what astronomers call metals, which is, I guess, everything but hydrogen and helium. Most of the Earth is made up of all these elements up here, magnesium, silica, iron, oxygen. And what you also notice on this plot, though, is that even chondrites, this primitive material, they're depleted in the gases, the most volatile elements, the noble gases here. Here's hydrogen, nitrogen, carbon. But of the building blocks, the CI chondrites have the most of these volatile elements, and we'll look at why that's the case shortly. So how much water is there? Let's just take a first stab at that. And we'll look at some various bodies in our solar system. The Earth, of course, we think of as the big blue planet because it's covered in an ocean of water. We'll talk more as the talk goes on about how much we think might be inside. But if we use that one ocean as our normalizing factor, then we can already tell that there are other objects, some of them much smaller and further out, that have much more water than Earth. So Ganymede, for example, one of the satellites of Jupiter, on the basis of Hubble measurements of the wobble and interpretations of that wobble on the basis of interactions of the magnetic field of Jupiter with magnetic field of Ganymede, the way you can do that is have about six oceans of water underneath the crust. Titan also probably has a lot of water in the subsurface. That's also from tidal fluctuations from the Cassini mission. Europa, Enceladus, we know that they both have oceans of water underneath their icy surfaces. Mars is interesting. We don't know exactly how much water Mars has, but on the basis of deuterium to hydrogen ratios that we can measure now in the Martian atmosphere, and then comparing that to meteorites, and using a model that says, well, how can we go from a DH ratio that we see in the oldest materials from Mars to the one we have now, using an atmospheric outgassing model, you can calculate that Mars had maybe a similar amount of water on its surface that the Earth has today, a bit less, I guess, about 0.01% of its total mass. So not as much as the Earth has on its surface. So quite a wide variety on these objects, and there seems to be some correspondence to heliocentric distance. So how do we understand this? Let's start and go back to solar nebular condensation then. So what we're showing here is estimates of the midplane temperature in our system as a function of distance in AUs. And so these red curves are estimates of the temperature gradient in the midplane. And what we can do is we can calculate on the basis of thermodynamic models when various elements and compounds condense from the nebula. And so, for example, refractory metals like tungsten and tantalum will condense at the highest temperatures. And then as you move farther out from the sun and cool, then oxides and silicates begin to form. And the important point here on this diagram is this thing called the snow line. It's beyond that snow line, you may have heard of this concept before, is where water ice begins to condense from the nebula. The temperature is down around 200 degrees Kelvin, cool enough for water ice and eventually ammonia ices and all the kinds of volatile rich components that we know are part of the giant planets, for example, and their satellites. They can condense beyond the orbit of Mars, somewhere basically in the asteroid belt. As the structure stands today. So to first order, we can understand this division between wet things farther out in the solar system and our planet, which is maybe relatively drier. And one might even ask the question, why do we have any water at all? Because it shouldn't have condensed this far into the solar system. Now, there are other compounds that it may condense with, rather than as a pure water ice or some other kind of ice. But for the most part, we can ask that question, why isn't our planet completely dry? And it has to do a bit with planetesimal theory. I'm going to brush through about, 40 or 50 years worth of modeling, computational modeling, and give you the short version of planetesimal theory. If you're interested more about this subject, John Chambers at the Earth and Planets Laboratory does this kind of modeling for a career, and you might want to think about having him come talk to you if you have an interest. Basically, it works like this, and we start with dust and gas. So dust begins to condense in the midplane of the nebula, and it's a bit of a chaotic, turbulent place, and there are modeling now that shows that in things called streaming instabilities, you can get, what you might even want to call dust balls building up. And once these dust balls start to become dense enough, they can actually aggregate into pebbles and boulders. And it's these pebbles and boulders that eventually start running into each other. And there are issues about how that happens and at what rates and how much gas needs to be around still for them to not spiral into the sun and form larger objects. But we know we have planets, so it did happen. Eventually, you end up with boulders, and you end up with what we call planetesimal-sized objects. So these are of the order kilometers to maybe 10 to 100 kilometers, maybe at the maximum. Possibly this happens in the first 500,000 years after solar system formation. Then you kind of enter a different stage where a few of the objects are getting bigger than other objects. And when they do that, through a process called gravitational focusing and another process called dynamical friction, they end up in relatively stable orbits. And the large objects grow relatively quickly at the expense of the smaller ones. And this is sometimes called runaway accretion. It takes about 1 million years. And each of the objects are in very stable orbits during this time because they basically are constrained by smaller objects and some gas perhaps that's left to these relatively uniform orbits. And they carve out feeding zones. And so at that time, as the planetesimals are growing, they're basically growing from material that's maybe plus or minus 1 AU relative to their orbital radius, relatively uniform feeding zones. And so there, if you already have a nebula that is in some way zoned with respect to water, you might expect that things that are inside that ice line to basically accrete dry and those that are outside of the ice line to accrete more wet. Eventually, those planetesimals grow large enough and they basically have scooped up most of the smaller objects and materials that they're no longer constrained in their orbits, and you end up in a more chaotic phase where they start to scatter each other, they feel each other gravitationally, and you end up with a time period of larger impacts from which the final suite of planets emerges. And in our case, four planets. And it's really within that framework that we need to understand and try to make models of how Earth might have achieved its, or the inner planets in general might have achieved their water contents. Now, not all planets are created equal simply because of where they accrete and other processes that happen during the accretion process. And we can take a look at the distribution of objects now and at least get some understanding of the difference in the materials that may have gone into forming the Earth. Now, this is a plot that's showing the relative proportion of the kinds of materials in the asteroid belt. So we have these so-called S-type asteroids, which are achondritic, dry, differentiated. They're the remnants of planetesimals that have been disaggregated through collisions, basically. And we also have the iron meteorites coming from this inner region of the asteroid belt. And they also represent the cores of planets which have broken up due to collisions. And this is relatively dry material that we call S-type. Farther out, you get into the more primitive undifferentiated meteorites. These were part of objects that never melted. They never achieved temperatures high enough to melt and differentiate. They're made of matrix material, of minerals like olivine and pyroxenes. Many of the varieties have chondrules, which are these little bits of basically once molten glass that are very spherical in shape. And they also have a lot of water and organic matter. They're a bit goopy still. And they're a great source. They're a great potential source for water and other organic materials to accrete in during planet formation. But they occur fairly far out, 3 or 4 or 5 AU. So the question then is, where is Earth's water? Where does it come from? What kind of objects accreted to give Earth its water? And on this plot, we're showing relative water content. So this is an object's fraction of water by mass. And we see Earth as the green dot. It's got about 0.03 or 0.04% total water. That's not totally well known, but it's probably within a factor of 2 or 3, correct? EC is ensitite chondrite. They're very dry. So the ensitite chondrites are meteorites that probably formed in the inner part of the solar system. They're really dry. We'll take a look at some recent work in a second, which challenges that to some degree. The interesting thing about ensitite chondrites is that in some ways, it should be the material that the Earth accreted from, because we think they formed and dominated the inner part of the solar nebula. They're very reduced, very refractory, and they have isotopic compositions. I'm not going to show you this, but virtually every isotope that we look at, oxygen, nickel, titanium, chromium, you name it, they're pretty much a dead ringer for the Earth and for the Moon. And that's something which has been a challenge to understand, because their major element composition, if the Earth were made entirely of ensitite chondrites, we don't think we should have the kind of internal composition and structure that we think we have. So that's a very interesting tangent I won't be able to go into today. Then we see OC as ordinary chondrites, and they're also very dry. That's, again, part of that inner part of the asteroid belt that's dry. Then we see the carbonaceous chondrites that have about 10% water, and then comets, which have loads of water. Okay, so how do we know where Earth got its water from? One possible way is to look at their composition, and in particular, the ratio of deuterium to hydrogen. So this is a way to fingerprint these kinds of materials. And so here's the Del deuterium. This is basically just a way to look at variations in the deuterium-hydrogen ratio in parts per 10,000. And what we see is, relative to some standard, the standard is typically Earth in this case, so that's why it's probably zero. So here's the Earth. We see that the cometary objects have DH ratios which are very heavy relative to Earth, and they don't really make a good match. These are Jupiter-type comet objects, the Jupiter family comets, also too high. Some of the C chondrites, some of the undifferentiated chondrites overlap with Earth. CI chondrites overlap with Earth to some degree, although they have a lot more water in them. And we know that the Earth can't be made only of CI chondrite because they're far too volatile rich relative to the Earth. Vesta, Mars look a lot like Earth. The inner planets all seem to look relatively similar as far as we can tell. And so it's just unclear whether or not Earth's water was delivered by some of this material, like CI chondrites. One of the most common models is that the water was just delivered late, that Earth formed in a dry region. It formed relatively dry. But late addition of meteorites and asteroids added the water after it accreted. So sort of during the Hadean, when sometime between maybe 4 and 4.4, 4.5 billion years, that it's a late addition to the accretionary stage. That model's been challenged somewhat by a paper that came out just in the last month or so. And again, this schematic on the left really just gives a picture of what I said, dry anthracite chondrites forming in the interior of the nebula, wet carbonaceous chondrites farther out, and comets, you know, coming in and sprinkling water into the inner solar system kind of randomly. Well, this recent work by Piana et al., which just came out in Science, they did two things. They looked at the, and so EC represents anthracite chondrite here, and they looked at the bulk of the anthracite chondrite and then at the mesostasis, and they found that the anthracite chondrites have the right deuterium hafnium ratio to match the Earth very well, just like all the other isotope ratios that match for anthracite chondrite. And that more importantly, I don't have a diagram to show this, they argue that their recent analysis and very careful analysis shows that the water abundance in anthracite chondrite is higher than previously measured, and that it matches pretty well with what we think the overall Earth water content is. We've talked about this at some length in our group at EPL, because we have a couple of meteoriticists, Connell Alexander in particular is an expert on this kind of thing. And let's just say the jury's still out on this paper. There's lots of ways to analyze more water than is actually part of the primordial anthracite chondrite. And water can get in through cracks, and there's many ways to get it wrong. We're not saying it is wrong, but it's going to take more careful analyses, and people are going to have to be able to reproduce this. That's what you do in science, is you take a new finding and you see if you can reproduce it. So the jury's still out, so stay tuned on that one. But I think it's a really interesting result from the point of view that, again, pretty much everything we look at, anthracites seem to do a really good job of being at least a major component of the material that was accreted into form Earth. Another way to get water is an accretionary mechanism. And I'll go over this relatively quickly. It's something called the Grand Tack. And this is actually a model that, this is an N-body simulation. This particular one is done by Sean Raymond and his colleagues at Nice. And what they were trying to do in this model is to figure out why Mars is so small. Because when you look at the family of these kinds of N-body simulation that Sean and John Chambers at EPL and others do, the typical results are that Mars should be considerably bigger than it is. And so these guys were trying to figure out, well, why might that be? And they came up with this idea that maybe it has something to do with planetary migration. We can see that when you have giant planets in a young nebula, that due to gas drag, that they will migrate often in towards the sun. In fact, most of the large exoplanets that we observe have very short orbital periods and are very close to their stars. Jupiter and Saturn and Neptune, they're actually quite far out, and they seem to be really unusual. And so they took planetary migration into account in the physics of the accretion model. I'm going to show a little movie here. And what we see here, all these red dots, those are all the planetesimals that they start out with in their simulation. And then this big black dot is Jupiter, and Saturn is out there beyond Jupiter. So both Jupiter and Saturn are in the model. And you can consider that these red dots are in here. They're undergoing, they're accreting, they're undergoing planetesimal runaway growth. And what we're showing here is the inclination and the eccentricity of these objects. And what they modeled was planetary migration. And so you're going to see what happens. And as you might imagine, as Jupiter and Saturn migrate in, they scatter a lot of those planetesimals out, either out of the solar system entirely or into eccentric and highly inclined orbits. And eventually they may decay and and leave the system as well. But what this does is it provides a really sort of convenient way to eliminate material within the region that Mars would be forming. And so the reason in this model that Mars forms small is because there simply was not a lot of material there. The disk was truncated. Now, what does this have to do with water? Well, once they had this model, they thought, what happens when to Jupiter and Saturn at this point? And it turns out, as you can see from their orbits, they're right now in a 3-2 position, and they end up in this 3-2 resonance. And what happens is, when they end up in that 3-2 resonance, and that's shown in this model, we're looking at a bigger swath now of the nebula going all the way out to 9 AU. And so here's all the dry, and I should have pointed out that the red material is basically all dry. It's all inner solar system material. And the blue material out here is the wet stuff beyond the snow line, okay? So here's Jupiter and Saturn. They've migrated in. They've truncated the nebula. Now they're going to move back out. And what these models show is that they move back out, they scatter all of that wet material into the inner solar system. So not only is this a nice way to truncate the nebula and account for the size of Mars, but it's a very convenient way to scatter material from the outer solar system into the inner solar system. And so this is kind of the state of the art, and it's a model that has gained a lot of traction. Although in some ways it's a bit convenient and ad hoc, because you're just saying what happens if, rather than having primary evidence that it actually happened. So if, for example, ansatite chondrites can do the trick completely, then this isn't necessary, okay? And I'll leave that there. So before we go into the interior, I just want to show one more simulation, because, and this isn't my simulation again, this is a simulation from Robin Kanup at Southwest Research Institute, and I suggest if you're interested in this, please go look at her website. She's got a number of these kinds of simulations on as videos. And what Robin is showing here is the last stages of accretion for Earth. And in fact, the model for the way Earth's moon formed was in a late giant impact. And Robin and others have done hydrodynamic simulations to show what happens in these impacts, and specifically to look at the parameter space within which you can achieve a moon of the right size, the right orbit, with the right angular momentum. And this is a simulation that does all that. Now, what I'm interested in, want to show you here, is the color is scaled with respect to temperature. And so take a look at the movie. The object, a Mars-sized object, comes in and hits the Earth. That's about 90% of its total mass, of its final mass. And as you would expect, there's a tremendous amount of kinetic energy that's delivered to the Earth. And it results in large-scale heating, potentially heating and melting the entire object, so that the Earth would have started out in a very hot state. The idea here is that temperatures could have reached in excess of even 6, 8, or 10,000 degrees Kelvin. And the point is, even if it was wet, at this point, if it had any atmosphere at all, it would get blown off. What we don't know yet at this point, and this is kind of the realm of the current modeling, is when you have a big remnant hot silicate vapor disk that exists after the giant impact and probably encompasses both the moon, the proto-moon, and the proto-Earth, what the chemistry is, how much volatiles can be remained in that vapor cloud, and how much would recondense to the Earth. We know the moon is very dry, more dry even than the Earth, although there is some water in the moon. Actually, the more we look, the more we seem to find. But both Earth and Moon were probably pretty dry after this, and it may be that it's after they settled down, began to cool, differentiate, and crystallize, that water was delivered later, for example, by CI chondrites. So that's kind of where we're at in terms of the thinking. Of course, experts in the area could give you much more detailed knowledge and information about all of these things, but that's kind of a general sweep through of how Earth got its water, where it might have come from, but it doesn't really tell us how much we think the Earth has as an object. And that's, oops, I meant to go to the next slide. So we're going to change gears now. We're going to start looking on the inside. So we've looked outside. We have an idea of where the water may have come from. How much is on the inside? I don't know how much you know about the Earth's interior. I imagine you guys spent a lot of time looking outside of the Earth. The Earth is about 6,400 kilometers in diameter, in radius. And that equates to about 3.3 megabars or 3.3 million atmospheres at its center. So it's very high pressure, and that creates challenges in recreating the conditions. Not only that, but it's very hot inside. Most of that is leftover accretionary heat, actually, and radioactive heating. So that the core is around 6,000 degrees Kelvin, very similar to the temperature of the solar photosphere, coincidentally. And at the surface, of course, it's 300 Kelvin. And that big difference there also makes our planet a very dynamic place. So how do we look inside? We do that through a different kind of telescope. It's mostly done, not mostly, but one of the ways that we look inside is through seismology. So whenever you have an earthquake, so for example, the little red dot is an earthquake epicenter, then acoustic waves, seismic waves emanate out, there's compressional waves, there's shear waves, and they transit the planet through different paths, they bounce off boundaries within the planet that might represent changes in density. The biggest one is the density change, for example, between the iron-rich core and the rocky silicate mantle. And the waves convert into different kinds of waves, and you can gather all kinds of information by looking closely at the seismic energy and how it's distributed and how it moves within the planet. So we have a pretty good idea. It's kind of like ultrasound, right, for the Earth. And we have a pretty good idea of the interior structure from seismology. And so this is a one-dimensional section through the Earth, constructed solely on the basis of globally average seismic P and its compressional and shear wave velocities. So the red curve is the shear wave velocity structure, and the blue curve is the P wave velocity structure. And this results in a relatively simplified seismic section of how we think about the interior of the Earth. And I'll talk about the upper mantle, and the upper mantle is a region of relatively high and heterogeneous seismic velocity down to a depth of around 660 kilometers, where there's an abrupt change in seismic velocity that relates to a change in the mineralogy. And from 660 kilometers then down to 2,900 kilometers, we call that the Earth's lower mantle. It's also silicate. And then from 2,900 kilometers to the center is the Earth's iron core. Now, I'm not going to talk about the core today. It's a very unknown player in the water story. And the reason I say that is because during accretion and differentiation, imagine after that giant impact that formed the moon, most of the metal or all of the metal may have been molten. The object that hit the proto-Earth would have had a core, and it would have plopped down into that big molten ball. And the idea is that this is when the core segregated. And it segregated probably through molten droplets that rained down into the center of the planet. And if there was water around, that core metal can take quite a bit of hydrogen as an iron hydride. We don't know how much. These are very challenging experiments to do. And we can't really tell whether or not it's in the core or not. The core is mostly iron, but it has about 10% of elements that are less dense than iron. And we can use seismic velocities to discern what those elements might be, as long as we know equations of state of all of the different kinds of mixtures that might be possible. Hydrogen is one of those elements in the mix of things that could be in the outer core, for example. The outer core is molten. We know that because the shear wave velocity drops to zero at 2,900 kilometers, picks back up at around 5,200 kilometers again. So we know that the inner core is solid. And that outer core, as I said, has about 10% of light elements. We think it's mostly silicon and carbon and oxygen, but it could be hydrogen to some degree as well. That's a big unknown. My personal view is that there's not likely to be a lot of hydrogen in there simply because the planet was so hot and would have most likely lost all of its water as a vapor. We also can image the center or the interior of the planet through samples. And this is really key to our understanding. So we have magmas that erupt at the surface. So they were generated at depths of around 100 kilometers. That's pretty shallow, but it gives us some information about material that's melting to form those magmas. Those magmas sometimes bring up chunks of the mantle itself. So here's a lava that's carrying a chunk of the mantle. So this piece of mantle here melted to form that lava, basically. And this is a piece of this is how we know what the mantle is made of. It's through these chunks called xenoliths the magmas bring to the surface. And from this, we can sample about maybe a couple of hundred kilometers depth. So we have pretty good resolution. We know a lot about the upper couple hundred kilometers of the mantle because we have samples of it and a lot of them. Beyond that, we have to mostly rely on experiment. Okay, and this is really my area of expertise. We have a lot of different kinds of experimental kit, but I'm showing you one big press that we have at Carnegie. I welcome you to all visit sometime at the Earth and Planets Lab. I'd be happy to show you our facilities. And this is a big hydraulic press within which we put eventually a pressure cell that has a small little capsule in it, maybe a millimeter long and maybe a millimeter in diameter. And in that capsule, we can grind up rocks that we think make up the mantle, and we can subject them to very high pressures and temperatures. Then after the experiment's done, we can take them out and we can interrogate them with all kinds of techniques. We can look at the minerals that we make. We can look at their compositions. We can look at their physical properties, and a very important physical property that we look at is how they transmit seismic waves, so that we can relate those directly to the seismic velocities that we observe. And for this kind of experiment and this kind of apparatus, we now can peer down to about 700 kilometers. So that gets us just into the lower mantle. It leaves a lot left, though. And to do that, we move to a different kind of experimental apparatus, something called the diamond anvil cell. So this is a close-up. These are probably about third carat diamonds. These are natural gem quality diamonds. We file off the tips and the culets at the tip there is about a couple of hundred microns in diameter. And because pressure is force over area, the area is very small. We don't need a lot of force to produce extremely high pressures, and diamond is very strong material, the strongest material we know about. And so with this particular device, we can actually interrogate the entire pressure temperature range of our planet and even well into a planet like Jupiter. The record pressure in the diamond anvil cell is up around five megabars, so 5 million atmospheres. The nice thing about diamonds too is that they're transparent to all kinds of radiation. We can actually, you're looking down through the diamond anvil at an experiment that's at pressure. So this could be at a megabar pressure. We have a little chip of sample in there, and we can do all kinds of things to torture that sample. We can fire lasers in there and heat it up to very high temperatures. And then while the lasers are heating it to very high temperatures, we can interrogate it with X-rays or other lasers, and we can measure structures, crystal structures, we can measure physical properties and a whole range of other things about the material of interest. Okay, so from all that, we've got our seismology, we've got our experiments, we've got samples. That's how we put together this framework of what we think that the mantle is made of. Okay, what is it made of from the surface down to 2,900 kilometers? Oops, too quick. And what we find is that the upper mantle is composed of a mixture of the mineral olivine, which you may be familiar with, garnet, and pyroxene. And we know that because that's what comes up in these rocks. And it stays that way for about 400 kilometers depth. And then we see from experiments that the olivine goes through a phase change. And it changes into a mineral called wadsleyite. Pretty similar to olivine, has the same composition, but it's a different mineral structure. And this is really important with the water story, and I'll tell you why in a moment. And then that wadsleyite eventually converts to something called ringwoodite. And then ringwoodite breaks down at 660 kilometers to a whole new phase called bridgmanite, plus something called ferropericlase and something called calcium perovskite. Okay. This phase transition is associated with quite a density contrast. And so we see that really well in the seismology. That's what this deflection of the wave velocity is. We can also see the olivine-wadsleyite transition really well in the seismological structure with this velocity contrast. And it turns out it's due to those phase transformations. This is called the 410 kilometer discontinuity. This is the 660 kilometer discontinuity. And in between there, we see this relatively high seismic velocity gradient. And so this is called the transition zone. The Earth's transition zone is this layer between 400 and 600, basically 700 kilometers. And there's a lot of action, as it turns out, in the transition zone, especially with relation to this water story. So why is that? Well, we've also been able to measure what I'll call the water capacity of the rocks that make up the upper mantle, the transition zone, and the lower mantle. That is, how much water can those minerals store in their structures before another mineral that's maybe a hydrated mineral would form, okay, which we don't think is actually there. So in the upper mantle, that's about 100 to 500 ppm. And that amount is really similar to the amount of water that we see in some kinds of basalts that we know melts that come from the upper mantle. They're also quite dry. So that's not a huge amount of water, 100 ppm. But then when you go into the transition zone, that changes big time. And this was a real surprise, I think, when we discovered this about 20 years ago. And it turns out that when olivine changes to wadsleyite, that structural transformation is such that there are some under-bonded oxygens in the crystal structure that hydrogen can connect to and make little OH units. And so they're kind of little sponges for water. Both wadsleyite and ringwoodite have this capacity to store weight percent levels of water. So if you take the maximum amount of water that you can put in these minerals at transition zone conditions, about 10,000 ppm, then you can store about 2 or 3 oceans worth of water just in the transition zone. Okay, so that is the potential to store a lot of water. The lower mantle is a bit uncertain. Some results are that you can only store about 10 ppm. Others go up to around 1,000 ppm. They're very difficult and challenging experiments to do. And so there's quite a bit of uncertainty there. But I would say it's probably something in between. And maybe the lower mantle, because of its big mass, it's something like 60% of the mass, it can store another several oceans of water, even if it's very dry. But because you can have that much water, doesn't mean you do. Okay, so it has the capacity to have oceans worth, maybe 5 oceans worth of water in the mantle might be its storage capacity. But it doesn't mean it is in there. So we've got to try to figure out whether it actually is, okay? Now the interior is a very dynamic place. This gives a very static view, right? We have these minerals, this is where they're stable. We have kind of a layered structure. We can see that from seismology, but actually it's a very dynamic interior because it's losing heat. It's got thermal boundary layer at the top where it's got this lid of continents and crust. It's got a boundary layer between the core and the mantle, and the core is very hot, and the heat from the core is trying to escape, and the way that it does that escapes to the surface. Conduction is way too slow. It actually convects. So it moves like a fluid on geological timescales. So the of the order of maybe a turnover rate in the mantle of maybe a billion years. So perhaps over the age of the Earth, 4.5 billion years, it might have turned over 4, 5, or 6 times. So it's glacially slow, even slower than glaciers, but it moves like a fluid and it convects. And that's important because it affects our surface so much. And that's why we have plate tectonics. So we all have all these plates that are floating around on that gooey convective mantle. And this is important, really important for the water story and understanding how much water is in the planet. We know from the kinds of magmas, so at the plates are spreading at mid-ocean ridges and they're forming new oceanic crust as they do that. That's material, that's magma that's coming directly from the mantle beneath. And we know from looking at the water contents of those magmas that they come from a relatively dry part of the mantle, that mantle has maybe 100 ppm, which is consistent with what I showed you earlier. However, we also have magmas that are forming at convergent margins. This is places where plates are coming together and one plate is subducting or moving underneath another plate. And when those plates, one plate subducts under the other plate, we see that we invariably have volcanoes at the surface. And the magmas that come out of those convergent margin type volcanoes are wet. And they have in their primitive magmas the estimates of about 4 weight percent water, which means that's a source probably had something order of a weight percent or so. That's very wet. So why does that happen? So water is recycled in the interior at subduction zones. This is a really unique aspect of our planet relative to any other planet that we know of in the solar system. It has this plate tectonic engine. It has this connection between the surface and the interior of the planet through subduction. So oceanic crust sits there beneath an ocean of water, and it does that before it subducts for on average about 200 million years. So it reacts with that water, it forms hydrous minerals, the water gets down into the cracks, there's cracks and fissures in the oceanic crust. And as it does so, it creates new minerals that are hydrated. And as that crust eventually begins to subduct, those hydrous minerals subduct as well. Minerals like talc that you're familiar with, chlorite and serpentine. These are the minerals that form in the subducted material that's moving down into the deeper mantle. Now, what this diagram shows, this is pressure or depth, and this is a schematic of the subduction zone. These dashed lines in here, you don't need to pay attention to details, but they're showing the experimentally determined stability fields of these minerals. In other words, at what pressure and temperature do those minerals destabilize and release their water? Well, it turns out that in the oceanic crust, this black layer here, which is about 6 kilometers thick, that pretty much all of the minerals dehydrate by about 100 kilometers. They just get too hot, they can't stand the heat and the pressure anymore, they give up their water, and that water moves up into the mantle above, lowers its melting point, and that's why we have magma generation and volcanoes all around the Pacific Ocean, for example, the Ring of Fire, where we have subduction. So the plate is being really stripped of nearly all its water, and most of it, we think, basically comes back to the surface. So we've got this deep hydrological cycle that keeps recycling the water back into the atmosphere and oceans over sort of a 100 million year time frame. Maybe that cycle is really important for why the Earth has been able to keep its oceans and its atmosphere at a fairly constant, we think, level for the past 4 billion years. There's not a lot of apparent change in the freeboard, the amount of continent that's above the ocean over that time. Just another way to look at that is we have this magma generation. I just wanted to put this in. I think I'm running out of time. I need to speed up a little bit. But I wanted to point to this mineral here, serpentine, because in the oceanic crust, I said it dehydrates, and it does almost completely. But in the mantle part of the lithosphere that's subducting beneath the crust, there's this mineral serpentine that can hold 10 weight percent water. This is a really hydrous mineral. And it's in a relatively cool part of the subducting package, the subducting lithosphere. Now, most of the water, as I said, comes out of volcanoes, and that's recycled, and I'll move quickly forward now. So let's talk about this transition cell. So how much of this water, the idea is, can subduction take water to the level of the transition zone? Because if it can, you can almost think of this as filling up a bathtub, right? Over geological time, 4 billion years of subduction, if it's continuously pumping water into the planet, maybe the planet started out relatively dry, then that would mean that we were filling up this transition zone and you can store several oceans of water in the transition zone. And we said that's because Wadsleyite and Ringwoodite can store so much water. So how do we know? How do we get at this problem? One way is through diamonds. And diamonds are very unique. And this is another thing that I and my colleagues study at the Earth and Planets Laboratory, is these very rare samples that have information from these kinds of depths. Now, most of the diamonds in your jewelry, if you have a diamond ring or whatever, they come from what we call the cratonic lithosphere. That's the cold bit of mantle that is kind of glommed on to the base of the continent and anchors it into the mantle. And it extends down to about 300 or 400 kilometers. And this is where most diamonds form. And most diamonds that come to the surface in these special kinds of magmas called kimberlites that bring them there, they form in this region. There's a very small percentage of diamonds that we know come from deeper, some of them as deep as 600 or 700 kilometers. And these are so-called super deep diamonds. And we know that they come that from those depths because they carry small little mineral inclusions inside of them that have the right mineralogy that they only could have come from these kinds of depths. Again, that's another story for another lecture. But we're going to use these as well to probe this water story a little bit. And again, these diamonds can give us direct samples all the way down into the lower mantle. So a few years ago, a colleague of ours called Graham Pearson, shown here at University of Alberta, he found for the first time, and it's still the only one, he found a sample of ringwoodite. So ringwoodite is that polymorph of olivine that exists in the transition zone that can carry all that water. This is the blue mineral right under the picture of Graham is actually a mineral synthesized at high pressures and temperatures. That's a ringwoodite full of water at high pressures and temperatures. And you can see the similarity of the blue color in the diamond. And that's what actually made them think, wow, what is that? It's got the same color as ringwoodite. And so they did some Fourier transfer analysis on that, and they found that sure enough, it's full of water. They did some X-ray crystallography, and they found out sure enough, it's ringwoodite. So here they have a piece of the transition zone for the first time that actually has water in it. Now, that doesn't mean that the whole transition zone is full of water, because diamonds may be forming in very specific environments that contain water, but it is at least the first evidence that we have that there is water at those kind of depths in the planet. And I just love this headline at the time from, I think it was the Saskatchewan Register, Satanic Hell Diamond Tells of Sunless Subterranean Sea. So that was even before the epoch of fake news that we live in. Maybe that was the start of it. We also have another direct determination of water from these kinds of super deep diamonds. We'll call this ice in ice. And this is a study by Oliver Chowner at Las Vegas. And what they found is actual ice in the cracks of some of these super deep diamonds. And in particular, something called ice 7. And ice 7 is a high pressure polymorph of ice that only exists at high pressure. So they know this must have been primordial. It wasn't water that was added to the diamond on the way to the surface. It had to have come from depth, and they estimate depths of around the transition zone again for that ice. Fortunately, it wasn't ice 9. How many of you get this particular reference? Oh, I thought this might be the group for it, yes. Ice 9 actually does exist. It exists at very low pressures right down in here below ice 2. At any rate, we have this evidence now for direct water coming from the deep mantle. I'm going to end. I hope we have time to do this. If I can take 5 more minutes to show you some recent work that I've been doing with colleagues at the Earth and Planets Laboratory, Steve Shirey and Peter Van Kecken and Laura Wagner, together with Graham Pearson at the University of Alberta. And we all have different areas of expertise. I'm an experimental petrologist. Steve is a real expert on these diamonds, and Peter Van Kecken does thermal modeling of subduction zones, and Laura Wagner is a seismologist. One of the great places about working at a place like Carnegie is that we're all in the same place. You know, we used to be together eating lunch together and that kind of thing. And so we get to talking, and all of a sudden, we kind of mesh together with ideas, and a new project is born. And this is one of those. So there's this really interesting thing about seismicity related to subducted slabs, and that's what's shown on this diagram. So on the left here are one of Peter Van Kecken's thermal models for a subducted slab in the Flores Sea. And all the little dots here are seismic events related to that subducted slab. And this is typical of the global pattern of seismicity related to these subducting slabs. And that's what's shown in the right histogram here, where you have number of events over the last 30 years. And you see that there's a lot of shallow earthquake events, and we understand these pretty well. But there's this deeper mode of earthquakes that occur at around 600 kilometers. These are called deep focus earthquakes. They're some of the most energetic earthquakes that happen on the planet, and they happen in a place where we shouldn't have earthquakes happening at all because it's too hot for rocks to break this brittlely. We would think they should deform plastically at these depths, but we have them. They're there, and it's been an enigma in the seismology and petrologic communities for a long time, and we think we have potential evidence for one of the possible answers to explain these earthquakes. So let me take you through this really quickly. Here's a pressure temperature diagram. And what this diagram shows, here's this mineral serpentine. And remember we said serpentine exists in that colder mantle part of the subducting slab, not the oceanic crust that we know is getting dehydrating, forming the magmas that come to the surface with all the water in them, but deeper down, okay? And when we plot the stability of those magmas, and that's what's being shown here in this phase diagram. Really, all you need to do is look at the black line and that gray area. Because what it shows is in the blue area, you've got phases that are hydrous phases that can store water. And the gray area, they dry out. That's the dehydration curve. And what you see is there's this region, this low temperature dip at around 5 or 6 gigapascals, where the dehydration curve is at its minimum. And what we noticed is that when you plot the temperature profiles that Peter Van Kecken calculates in his models for the modern subduction zones, you find that that cusp along the dehydration curve is kind of a perfect filter that discriminates between the red curves here that are subduction zones that don't show deep seismicity, and the blue curves, which are the subduction zones that do. And what this suggests is that there's a role for water in this process, that the blue ones are subducting water into the deeper mantle and the red ones aren't. This is our hypothesis. This is work that's actually not even published yet. This is submitted, so you're getting the first look at it. Now we know that when slabs go into the transition zone, they tend to stall. Eventually, they go all the way to the core mantle boundary. But these are tomographic seismic images of real subducting slabs. This is in the Japan plate in northern Honshu. And so what you're seeing in this blue image, this dark blue image, is the subducted plate that is stagnated in the transition zone. And when it stagnates in the transition zone, it can sit there and heat up. Okay, so why is that important? It's important because this is that same phase diagram again, and now we've put on the mode of the seismicity on the bottom. You can see that. The green line represents a thermal model for the slab, and when it stagnates, the slab only has to heat up by a couple of maybe 100 degrees or 200 degrees at the most, and that can happen, according to Peter's modeling, in about 5 to 10 million years, and then it hits this dehydration line. And that where it hits that dehydration line is exactly where we see the diamonds forming. We know that for pressure estimates from certain minerals. And it's right where we see this peak in seismicity. So this is, in a way, our hypothesis is that the water is basically hydrofracturing. This is kind of fracking in the transition zone. Basically, you've got pre-existing cracks, you've got dehydration of the Wadsleyite and, or of the hydrous phases in the lithosphere. They cause an overpressure in that crack and eventually reduce the effective normal stresses to the point where the rock can break. And this may be the origin of the deep seismicity. So this is something which kind of ties together water in the deep mantle, evidence for water going into the deep mantle. Now that's about all I have. And I'm going to end by saying that the Earth is dry, I think, but it's wet enough, and it's wet enough to sustain life. And we're pretty lucky for that. We're right in the habitable zone. We're right at the distance where we can have that water on the surface. And it's probably the fact that we've got this dynamic interior and this long-term cycle of water into the mantle and back out again that maintains that ocean on the surface throughout its history. And thanks so much for listening. Sorry if I went a bit over, and I'm happy to take any questions.
You didn't really go over. You can talk longer. But I noticed in a much earlier slide, you had V sub S, the velocity of the S waves, two curves, not one.
Let's see, how far back was that?
More.
Not the best.
That's it. There are two V sub S's in kilometers per second.
Oh, I'm sorry. The black one here is density.
No. Oh, density. It's not. Okay.
Yeah. So the red, sorry about that. Yeah. The red one in this particular diagram is shear wave velocity.
Okay.
And then it turns out that you can also use basically normal modes of oscillation of the planet.
So if you know V sub S, that tells you the density.
Well, it
maybe
you don't get it directly because that requires that you already have a pre-knowledge of what it's made of to get to density, but we can measure density directly from seismicity from a certain part of the spectrum. Basically, they're called the normal modes. It's kind of like whenever an earthquake goes off, the earth rings like a bell.
Right.
And from those normal modes of oscillation, you can invert to density.
Right. And this week at Carnegie, there was a Bridgmanite lecture.
Yes, exactly. So that's right. You saw Dan Frost's lecture, and so he was talking about this mineral bridgmanite, which makes up most of the lower mantle.
Wow.
Why, in the different ways that Earth received its water,
yeah.
Why, how does that explain the fact that the moon is relatively dry compared to the Earth? Why didn't it get more water?
Well, that's interesting. One explanation is that the Earth is much more likely to capture late stage material than the moon simply because of its gravitational cross section. That is the easiest explanation. The moon is very dry, and it even looks like it's more devolatilized when you compare its potassium uranium ratio. It's even potassium is quite volatile relative to uranium. It's one of the ways we look at the degree of volatile depletion in terrestrial rocks is relative, rather than looking at things like water, we look at other volatile elements. And so you can look at the potassium ratio, uranium ratio of Earth and Moon. They're relatively similar. The Moon looks like it's a little bit more devolatilized. It may be because after the giant impact that the Moon formed and it's in a region that most of the material that were created back to the Earth relative to the moon. And so it just remained a little bit drier. Now, it's also true though that the more we look at the moon, the more we're finding evidence of water. So yeah. one of our recently, unfortunately deceased staff members, Eric Cowrey, maybe some of you had heard or know of Eric. He was an expert at looking at water in all kinds of things, but the moon especially. And Eric and his colleagues were some of the first to look at lunar glasses and discover that they actually had more water than we thought they did. And while we still think that the Earth the moon is relatively depleted and volatile relative to the Earth, maybe not as much as we originally thought.
We have a couple of questions within the chat window. One is from Manjunath. Do you want to ask your question, Manjunath?
Sure. Dr. Walter, what about the role of gravity in retaining the water in these protoplanets? Because gravity is supposed to play a big role, is it not, for the planet to retain the water? Otherwise, it would escape from its surface?
Absolutely. And that's another good explanation for the Moon-Earth difference in volatiles. So you do need to be big enough to retain an atmosphere. However, I think maybe more critical to understanding the water contents of the different planets is their late accretion history. So for example, Earth is definitely big enough to have retained an atmosphere and to hold on to a thick vapor atmosphere. And it probably did have an early, we don't know what the early water content was of the Earth before the late stage giant impact. And there was probably more than one of those impacts. In fact, if you look closely at certain isotopes of noble gases like xenon and iodine relative to argon and other noble gases, the best way to explain the isotopic signature that we see from mantle rocks is that more than one atmosphere had to have been lost. And so most likely we lost atmospheres, we lost early water, and water was delivered late. For me, that's really good evidence that the water was delivered late rather than ensitite chondrites providing just the right amount that we have, because we would have lost water during the giant impact phase of Earth formation.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Quiet audience tonight.
Was a fantastic talk.
Yes.
Well, thank you.
Feel free to unmute yourself to ask a question. Don't be shy.
One more question, Dr. Walter. You said that the moons, the Jupiter moons, and even the Saturn moon, the Enceladus, we know that there is a lot of water coming to this, I mean, being spurt out into the space. So how come water is being retained in those far-off objects, even though their gravity may be very small in compared to Earth?
That's a good question. So if I think of, say, Enceladus, that, you know, it may be simply because it's receiving all of its volatiles from Saturn, right? And its water is also underneath a ice cap, basically. I think the ice is quite thick. I'm trying to remember exactly about Enceladus, but I know Enceladus is the one that has the geysers, if I remember correctly.
Right. Yeah. So even before the ice was formed, that small moon held on to its water, though the gravity should be very less than compared to Earth.
But you also have the interplay with solar heating, don't you?
Yeah, that's a good question. I don't know the answer to it. I mean, I guess if it's kind of bathed in water from Saturn and from nebular gases that are accreting to Saturn, I'm not even sure when Enceladus formed. Perhaps it freezes relatively quickly and holds onto its water, and maybe it all accreted as ice actually, and then through tidal heating, maybe that's what you're getting at. Through tidal heating, it melts, and so it's melting in the interior.
Okay. Cool. Thank you again.
You need to unmute.
Any other questions?
Yes, this is John Wetmore. where do you find the deep diamonds, and how difficult are they to find?
They're difficult in the sense that they're a very small percentage of the diamond population, but you can find them in any diamond locality. So wherever you have a kimberlite and where they're mining for diamonds, some proportion of those diamonds will be the so-called super deep variety. There are a few locations that have produced unusually large amounts. For example, my group has studied diamonds from a place called the Juína region in Brazil. And it's a very fertile region for these kinds of diamonds. The first ones that were discovered were from South Africa, as you might have thought. But now we've got these kinds of diamonds from every location, basically. But they're very rare, and they're not easy to get a hold of. So we're taking the approach now of we go down to the Amazon, and the local farmers now realize that one way to make some extra money is to basically go through all their fields and create sluices, and there's a lot of detrital diamonds. And so they produce bagfuls of these things. And the nice thing about the super deep diamonds that we study is that they're usually not the very pretty diamonds. They're usually pretty grungy. And so nobody wants them anyway. And so we can go down and we can buy a big bag full of diamonds. Unfortunately, it's not easy to bring them back. You've got to go through all kinds of protocols to get the diamonds shipped, but we have access to them.
There's an interesting article in the most recent Science News remarks on diamonds being used for carbon study. And it said that the Hope diamond is a deep diamond.
Yes, that is a, you know, I had a slide in there about that. And because it also plays into the story of water in a very interesting way. And this was a very interesting discovery about some of the biggest diamonds are actually now thought to be super deep diamonds. And my colleague, Steve Shirey at EPL works on these very diamonds. And he does so by a collaboration with colleagues at the Geological Institute of America in New York, where all these diamonds come through. And so they have scientists now that will take these big gem quality diamonds, and they have little inclusions in them. And they don't polish them or anything like that and ruin them like we do with our little diamonds, but they use various types of non-invasive spectroscopy to look at those inclusions. And surprisingly, what they discovered is that many of them carry these very, very high pressure diamonds, these very deep diamonds. And in particular, an interesting part of that story is the blue diamonds. The blue diamonds, the big blue diamonds like the Hope, they're very rare. And they're blue because they have boron. And one place where you have boron going into the mantle, and boron's a very rare element, it's a very low abundance element, but one place that you have it being subducted into the mantle is in serpentine minerals. So it connects this story of water being delivered into the transition zone. And so the authors of those studies have suggested that the boron in the diamonds is actually coming from the serpentine in subducted lithosphere that breaks down, forms that water. The diamonds, the water basically scavenges carbon and crystallizes diamond in the mantle. And it's that same water that we are saying is generating those deep focus earthquakes. And we've even gone so far, and I know I'm in the arm waving part of my talk now, is a real quandary about those diamonds is they're huge. Where are you growing a diamond like that at 600 kilometers depth? One potential place is in cracks that are forming, you know, maybe every time you have a deep focus earthquake, you're growing a diamond. Right? Because that's a place where you've got fluids flowing, you've got cracks, perhaps opening and shutting, and it may be a location to grow big diamonds. Very speculative that.
There was also a question from Joe Rauscher. Joe? He was asking if the Earth's oceans are due to the orbital migrations of Jupiter and Saturn.
Possibly in the sense that that's one mechanism for scattering wet material from the outer solar system into the inner solar system. That's a good way to get the material that you need to deliver. So for example, CI chondrites have a pretty good match with the DH ratio of Earth's oceans, pretty good match or for the Earth's mantle, water in the Earth's mantle, pretty good match for, and they have plenty of water. So if you can scatter some of that material in late, after the giant impact, after the planet has settled down a bit, late bombardment of asteroidal material, then that may be when the water is added. Yes, it's one of the models for how it's added.
That's the Grand Tack.
That's the Grand Tack. Yeah.
All right. Nancy has a question.
Yeah, I was wondering about the water storage capacity of Bridgmanite.
Yes, that's a very good question, and I've worked on that some myself. And you basically end up with kind of two camps amongst the experimental community. There is a number of people who, and some of the earlier work about two decades ago, some of the first work on Bridgmanite, the measurements showed that it was basically completely dry, that it had about 10 ppm water. The most recent measurements indicate about 1,000 ppm water, and that's quite a difference. My view is that it's very hard to measure too low, but it's really easy to get it wrong too high. And part of the reason is because when you synthesize Bridgmanite at high pressure in hydrous systems, you have to add water in there. These are water saturated. In other words, we're adding loads of water in to see how much water you can store. It's easy to form inclusions, very, very, very small inclusions of hydrous minerals. And if you don't know they're there and you're doing some kind of bulk analysis, then you're actually not analyzing the Bridgmanite, you're analyzing something else. That's one possible explanation for high water in Bridgmanite, although the most recent study seems to show pretty convincingly that they didn't have those inclusions. It's a bit up in the air still. We've also done ab initio. These are computer models of the Bridgmanite structure, and those models tend to indicate that you can have some hundreds of ppm of water, but certainly not more than 1,000 ppm. That's probably the maximum. We have a question. Go ahead. You have your hand raised. Yeah.
Yeah, I was wondering if the reservoirs, the great reservoirs like the Ogallala, that are used to irrigate vast areas of farmland in the Great Plains, is that water from deep into the earth, or is that simply water that accumulated there from rainfall over thousands of years?
I'm pretty sure it's the latter. I think that the Ogallala is a sandstone, and my recollection, and this is pushing me back to my undergraduate days at the University of Nebraska, by the way, where the Ogallala outcrops. So the Ogallala runs from Nebraska all the way to Texas, and it outcrops, it reaches the surface in western Nebraska, that sandstone. So I think it's really meteoric water, it's runoff that percolates down. So sandstones are quite porous, and so it's recharged from surface rain and meteoric water. I don't think it's probably deep water.
Okay, thank you. Mm-hmm.
Leland, want to unmute yourself?
My question is the diamonds that are forming in the mantle, just really, how do they ever make it up to the Earth's surface? And do they have to go through volcanic activity as they get very close to the surface, or are they able to get there by some other mechanism?
Yeah, that's a great question. Because they form so deep. It turns out, if I go back to the slide, where was that? This slide here. Yeah, I put a little schematic of this little carrot-shaped structure here. And diamonds are transported to the surface in a very special and very rare kind of magma. It's called a kimberlite. And kimberlites form very deep. So the answer to your question is that they're being transported from depths of probably of the order 300 to maybe maximum 400 kilometers in these kimberlites. The deeper diamonds seem to be made deep, transported into the mantle through solid state mantle flow, because the mantle is convecting, up to a position that's shallower, probably at the base of what we call the lithosphere. And then that's where kimberlites are forming. And kimberlites are very volatile rich magmas. They're full of water and CO2. And that water and CO2 is probably, and they're very small degree melts. So I look at it like at the base of the lithosphere, whenever you have some kind of perturbation, you have a little tiny bit of melting, and all of the water and the CO2 goes into those melts, and they're incredibly explosive. They're totally volatile rich, very at very high pressures. The estimates are that those kimberlites come to the surface from those depths in a matter of days. You would not want to be around when one of these explodes. I don't think we've ever actually witnessed one. Humankind that I know of has ever witnessed a kimberlite eruption. Then they're basically in place. Sometimes they break through the surface, but most of them are placed in these carrot-like structures. They're called diatremes. And that's what they're mining. So if you go onto Google and Google one of the diamond mines, you'll see a big circular pit. And they're mining right down into the top of one of those kimberlite diatremes. And all of the diamonds, well, not all, but nearly all of the diamonds that are being mined for jewelry, everything else, they all come from kimberlites, all of them, or a very similar type of magma. It's a great question.
Okay, well, we're coming up on 9 o'clock. I guess if we can, unless we have any more questions, if we can give our guest a round of applause.
Thank you so much, everyone. It was really a pleasure.
And so thank you very much. And we hope to see y'all, everyone, next month. If you register for all 10 meetings, it's generally the same link. Everyone has their own unique link. Okay, so we look forward to seeing you then. Have a good evening.
Thank you.
Bye-bye, everyone.
Bye-bye. Thank you, Mike.
Thank you.
Thank you. Super interesting talk.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks, everyone. Thank you.
Hi, Jeff.